Salo Falava. I'm Afamasanga Seyuli Salamasina Von Reiki, and I'm inviting you to join me on a journey through the evolution of our Pacific cultures on Culture Compass. We'll meet incredible people dedicated to preserving traditions while adapting them for today's world. Join me as we travel the Pacific to celebrate our resilience, revival, and deep-rooted connection.
Search for Culture Compass wherever you get your podcasts to listen.
This is an ABC podcast.
Janjo Vinaka Munmun Leanain, good fala morning. This is Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia. My name is Kristen Rita Aumanu Leong, and first we begin by acknowledging the land from which we broadcast. Pacific Beat comes to you from Yagara and Turrbal lands, now known by many as Brisbane. Coming up on the show, how are Pacific destinations tapping in on a niche tourism market for Australian high schoolers?
And so the young people who are enjoying the holiday ensure that they are, you know, extremely safe. No one else has access to them.
An NGO is fighting to protect women after the WHO reveals Solomon Islands as one of the worst countries in the world for violence against women.
Really, really frightening. And it's the future. If we do not do anything about this, the future of this country is very bleak.
And later in the show, how are some Pacific nations faring under a new system parachuted in by World Rugby? All that and more coming up. Tagyo Baita, thank you, Tomas, for sharing your time with me on ABC Radio Australia, yours in the Pacific. Well, we begin in Port Vila this morning, where a constitutional showdown is brewing. Earlier this week, the Supreme Court ordered Parliament to convene next week and a no-confidence motion against the Prime Minister to be held. But late yesterday afternoon, Vanuatu Speaker of Parliament went to the Court of Appeal to counter the move. To help us make sense of this legal and political tangle, we're joined by the ABC's Vanuatu reporter, Lily Rose Wellwell. With that, I say Alpowo, Lily Rose.
Alpo, Chrissy.
Afta, you're right?
Yes, me right.
See, okay, well, look, what's the latest? Will there be a no-confidence vote against the Prime Minister next week on Tuesday?
So, Chrissy, at this stage, it's uncertain. Earlier this week, the Supreme Court ordered Parliament to sit next Tuesday, 16 December, the day before the anniversary of the earthquake, so to debate the no-confidence vote. However, late yesterday afternoon, the Speaker appealed that decision to the Court of Appeal. Because of that appeal, the stay order was granted, which pauses the Supreme Court ruling. That means Parliament is not currently required to sit next Tuesday. Whether the vote happens now depends on what the Court of Appeal decides when it hears the case on December 17.
So, with the Court of Appeal ruling, Lily Rose, you know, let's take a step back to early in the week when the Supreme Court issued its own ruling. You know, what did it say?
The ruling from the Court of the Supreme Court states that the speaker was that it is unconstitutional when he closed Parliament on 14 November. The court found that the motion of no confidence had properly lodged and registered with the office of the clerk of parliament at 9:05 that morning. Once that happened, parliament was legally required to deal with it under Article 43(2) of the constitution, which governs motions of no confidence. The judge rejected the speaker's decision to close parliament and said that ruling aside, ordering parliament to reconvene so that the motion could be debated and voted on.
And Lily Rose, you know, just right after that ruling, the opposition leader, Ishmael Kalsakau, he was pretty confident about his chances of ousting the PM. But what about the reasons? What were the reasons for the motion, though?
Well, according to the motion that was lodged and that ABC obtained from the Office of the Clerk of Parliament, it sets out four main reasons explaining why the opposition says the Prime Minister no longer holds the confidence of Parliament. These concerns include the issuing of a diplomatic passport to a Chinese national who was wanted overseas, the failure to release a complete Commission of Inquiry report into the citizenship matter, the concentration of senior ministerial portfolios among MBs just from one island, and the government's handling of the nationwide teachers' strike. One of these issues is linked with an ongoing police investigation that was one of the key reasons the speaker cited when he ruled the motion was out of order.
So from these reasons that you mentioned earlier, what's the word on the streets? You know, what are people in Vanuatu thinking? You know, are people aware that Vanuatu could potentially lose a prime minister in the coming weeks?
People are generally aware of the situation, but the reactions are mixed. And one of the reasons was because, you know, it was one of the contents of the reasons why there was supposed to be the vote of no confidence was issued in the first place was because a lot of people are complaining about why there was no Commission of Inquiry report released to the public, why the teachers' strike was prolonged. So there are mixed reactions, but mostly people are aware of what's happening, and people are concentrating on why there were strikes and all that, and that the government was slow to deliver. So there is a mixed reaction amongst people.
So there's mixed reactions there in Vanuatu. But I guess one of the most important question here is who is going to foot the bill? You know, is the cost of staging a no-confidence vote going to come out of taxpayers' pockets?
Yes, potentially. If Parliament is required to sit to debate the motion, MPs are entitled to sitting allowances covering the period from November 14 to December 16, where it's the ordinary session of Parliament. The opposition estimates that could cost around 16.6 million, which that figure has attracted That's in Fatu. The figure has attracted attention because it comes at the time where public service under pressure, and it added to the wider public discussion about financial impact of political decisions.
Well, there's no doubt, Lily Rose, you will be looking, you'll be across this in the weeks ahead. But thank you, Tomas, for time with you this whole morning.
Thank you, Drew.
That was Lily Rose Well, the ABC's reporter in Vanuatu.
You're listening to Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
Welcome back to Pacific Beat. I'm Chris and Rita Aumanu Leong. Well, between November and December every year, thousands of Australian high schoolers travel to holiday destinations to mark the end of the secondary school education. Known as schoolies, it is considered a rite of passage for Australian kids. The Gold Coast in Queensland is a favourite destination, but so too is Fiji and Vanuatu, and these specific destinations are tapping in on this niche tourism market. Finau Fonua with this report.
Ask any young Australian what they'll do at the end of their high school era, and schoolies is a common response. This unique Australian tradition gives school leavers a chance to let their hair down. Queensland's Gold Coast is the usual destination for schoolies, with over 15,000 travelling there last year alone. But Pacific countries are also getting in on the act. Fiji is the most popular destination in the Pacific region for schoolies. There aren't official numbers on the number of schoolies visiting Fiji, but according to the Sydney Morning Herald, over 2,000 graduates visited Fiji in 2011.
It's a closer, more safer destination.
Christopher Cocker is the CEO of the South Pacific Tourism Organization. He welcomes schoolies, saying it opens up a new market, different from the usual target demographic of families and couples.
It's a great opportunity for our Pacific Islands because it's a niche, and we do encourage niche segments, etc., to come over.
Many schoolies are organized by students under the guidance of their teachers. They typically travel to tourism hotspots. It's an emotional event for the young Australians as they bid farewell to each other before embarking on their separate journeys into adulthood.
So one of my other friends, she was dancing with these two guys.
However, schoolies are also notorious for wild parties and underage drinking, with videos of wild antics often going viral on social media. But Pacific tourism operators say the schoolies' experience in Fiji and Vanuatu is something anxious parents might be happier with than other destinations.
Despite it being slightly higher for the average parent to send their child for a holiday in Fiji, it is deemed far safer than if they were to go to, let's say, the Gold Coast.
Fantasia Lockington, CEO of the Fiji Hotels and Tourism Association, says that Fiji offers special packages that book out entire resort islands that are kept alcohol-free and with extra security.
There's a lot of preparation that gets taken by the resorts that are what we call bought out. So it is just only dealing with schoolies and the teachers or support staff that come with them, and even parents. No one else is allowed on the island or into the resort. They use extra security. And so the young people who are enjoying the holiday ensure that they are, you know, extremely safe. No one else has access to them. There are no nightclubs that one could escape to.
Kylie Hogan, general manager of the Blue Lagoon Beach Resort, says Fijian resorts offer an escape from the noise and bright lights of Bali and the Gold Coast.
You know, they've got the option to disconnect from the real world as they know it, and they'll just go carefree for the entire stay. They feel really super comfortable and secure in amongst the environment and all of the team. And it very much is almost similar to village parenting, where it's a sense of family and it's a sense of security and it's a sense of fun and absolute just joy everywhere you turn.
Vanuatu is another country in the Pacific which has received positive reviews by schoolies on social media.
Vanuatu benefits enormously from Australian tourism.
Miranda Hodge, owner of the Havana Boathouse in Port Vila, says the growing Australian market is vital to the country's economy. Hodge says Vanuatu's ambitions to become a top-tier tourism destination has been maintained by its authenticity, that being the friendliness of its people.
I think what Vanuatu offers is a very authentic experience, and it's about getting back to nature and enjoying the unspoilt beauty of Vanuatu and the custom culture that we have here.
In Fiji, happiness comes naturally.
Tourism experts say the friendliness and simplicity of a Pacific Island holiday is what keeps bringing visitors back to the region.
It's not only looking at tourism as an economic benefit to our people in the region, but looking at it from a social perspective.
The Fijians are genuinely so warm and big-hearted that they welcome anyone and everyone into their islands with open arms. It's just a holiday like none other. A lot of people will pack away their phones and any link to the outside world as they know it, and they'll just go carefree for the entire stay.
Contrasting with the wild parties of the Gold Coast, Fiji offers an experience for young Australians to find inner peace from the untouched beauty of Pacific Island environments and the hospitality of its people.
That report there from the ABC's Finau Fonua. To Solomon Islands, where a World Health Organization report has ranked Fiji, followed by Solomon Islands, as the worst countries in the world for violence against women. In Solomon Islands, the report's release has sparked an outcry from men, while advocates have staunchly defended its findings. One NGO fighting to protect women is the Family Support Center. Its chairlady, Annika King-Mele, says there needs to be a strategic reset with advocacy programs, and men need to be brought in as part of the fight.
What I'm seeing now is that much of the focus is on response and awareness activities and not much programs or interventions that address men who are mostly the perpetrators. And so it would be good if we can also come up with programs that would target men as perpetrators or men supporting men within the domestic violence space.
And just with regards to comments that have been made on social media, especially from mostly by men, the argument is that women have too much rights. What do you say to this?
When it comes to rights, our rights are enshrined in our constitution. Well, it came from the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, and so it's called the Bill of Rights, and our constitution has in it, in Chapter 2 of our constitution, where it outlines the individual rights and freedoms of Solomon Islanders, and the constitution says a person. It doesn't say a woman or a man. It says a person, which is inclusive of both our sex.
What can you say about the statistics?
We men understand violence against women as only physical violence. Violence against women is not limited only to physical violence. It's both emotional violence. It's both. It's also psychological violence. It's also economic violence. So, the Family Protection Act came about to address these different forms of violence. The Act also defines domestic violence, which includes violence against women, as physical violence, sexual violence, economic, which also includes economic violence. And so probably I would assume that men would define violence against women as only being physical violence, but there are violence against women is also sexual violence, which is a taboo topic, and so we do not necessarily speak openly about it. But when they do access services, this is where the data is collected when it comes to violence against women. And Solomon Islands has been ranked also in the Family Health and Safety Study 2019 as highest in sexual abuse.
And would you say it's a true reflection of what you're seeing with the type of work that, you know, as a chair lady?
Well, the first study on violence against women was done in through the Family Health and Safety Study. And that at that time, the statistics was already alarming. And a lot of interventions, programs were developed and currently being implemented from since then, which are aimed to address violence against women, not only as preventative approaches, as well as response, i.e. through service. And now that this report has come about and has elevated this epidemic, so to speak, to another level, and it is really, really frightening. And it's in the future, if we do not do anything about this, the future of this country is very bleak.
And with the 16 days of activism as it lapsed on the 10th, what can you say about the collaborative efforts that's been put out by many stakeholders?
We've come a long way in the different interventions in terms of addressing violence against women, and we're still seeing the increase in numbers. It would be good if to go back and evaluate whether the interventions that we are doing are really addressing violence on the ground. And if so, we keep taking the same approach. If not, then probably we'll have to go back to the drawing board to do things differently.
That was Annika King-Mele, the chair lady of the Family Support Center, speaking there to me in Solomon Islands, capital of Honiara.
In the Fale is a music show on ABC Radio Australia, hosted by me, Paola Tukefu. I'll be spinning my favourite tunes from dancehall to disco, calypso to country, reggae to roots, and hip-hop to house music, from across the era to keep the kids and the aunties happy. If it has a pumping groove, I'll be bringing it to you to bump you into the weekend.
In the Fale, Friday afternoons at 3 PNG time on ABC Radio Australia.
Malo e tau mai pongpongi ni. Welcome to Pacific Beat. Well, a new report in health inequities in the Pacific Australia Labour Mobility Scheme is calling for all workers to get access to basic health services under Medicare. Currently, PALM workers do not qualify for Medicare and have to sign up to a private insurance scheme as part of their visa condition. But the study's lead author, Dr. Hayley Fox from Central Queensland University, told Lucy Cooper that workers are reluctant to go to the doctors when they get sick or are injured.
So what we found was there are extensive barriers to accessing healthcare for Pacific Island workers, particularly through visa requirements. They're not given access to Medicare. So not having access to Medicare was found to be one of the major barriers in terms of accessing healthcare. It creates a fear around cost, actual costs, workers being denied access to services because they don't have a Medicare card. And then the complexities and the limited coverage that is within the private health insurance that is mandatory for Pacific Island seasonal workers to have.
And how did you go about carrying out this project? What was it kind of made up with in terms of the certain elements you were looking into?
The study was undertaken via interviews, so one-to-one in-depth interviews that included with seasonal workers, it included health providers and employers. And then the second phase of the project was kind of just to like confirm what we've heard through surveys. So then we conducted surveys with the same population groups, and then we analysed all that data and went back out into the same population groups and presented our research findings and then co-designed recommendations and solutions from each of the groups of seasonal workers, employers and health providers.
What were some of those recommendations and solutions that you guys would like to see implemented?
Number one, and the most common thread in terms of recommendations and solutions would be removing cost barriers to healthcare through Medicare access. So extending Medicare access to all Pacific Island Australian, Pacific Australia Labour Force mobility workers.
And any other solutions?
Yeah, so I guess if Medicare isn't going to be given to this population group, then there needs to be serious reform to private health insurance, including the removal of waiting periods for chronic health conditions and also the inclusion of access to care for pre, peri and antenatal, postnatal healthcare.
And speaking to seasonal workers, many of whom are employed under the PALM scheme, was it really the fact that they're saying they didn't have money to access healthcare, or was there also an element of cultural stigma involved?
Fear of cost, actual cost, and seeing people, like their colleagues, experience significant costs and get huge medical bills was definitely one of the driving factors. But stigma also does play a part. I mean, we've brought 30,000 people over from Pacific Island countries who have totally different social norms, culture, languages, and we haven't prepared our health services here in Australia to be able to appropriately culturally respond to this population group. So there was a lot of fear, a lot of stigma around accessing healthcare specifically for certain health conditions.
What is the benefit to them coming under Medicare and not coming under private insurance?
To the PALM scheme worker themselves, and they know that they can go and access healthcare for free. So there's no fear of cost. I mean, PALM workers are on often minimum wage salary. So once they've paid for all their costs of living and everything, there might not be much left there. So the thought of going to see a doctor and not knowing how much it's going to cost is a really great deterrent. So having Medicare at least removes that barrier to the fear of cost, and they can, you know, it's something that we take for granted, I guess, just something basic as being sick and being able to go to the doctor. That they don't feel that they have that. They can't do that. And, you know, Australia has that human rights obligation to provide universal access to healthcare to all people, regardless of their migration status.
That was the report lead author, Dr. Hayley Fox of Central Queensland University. If you're just listening in to Pacific Beat, here are some of the stories that we've covered so far. A pre-Christmas constitutional showdown is brewing in Vanuatu as the government appeals a court order to recall Parliament to deal with no-confidence motion. Fiji and Vanuatu are tapping into the niche schoolies tourism market of Australian high school students travelling abroad to celebrate their graduation. And the Solomon Islands NGO fights to protect women after the WHO ranks the country as one of the worst in the world for gender-based violence. Well, stay with us because up next is our news wrap. Well, it's that time of the morning where we take a look at what's making headlines across the Pacific. And right opposite me here is our producer, Liam Fox. Good morning, Liam. Final day for you.
It is. I'm on Christmas holidays after today. It's great to have you in the same studio, seeing you in person. What a treat just before Christmas.
Yes, absolutely. Well, how has your year been?
Oh, look, it's been, as always, a big year. Lots of big stories in the Pacific. Struggling to think of them right now at this moment after having only had one coffee so far. But, yeah, looking forward to having a break for sure. I think I presented my last pack beat yesterday afternoon and sent out a happy Christmas message and a happy new year to all our listeners. Get through this morning's show. And then we're done for the year.
Well, another special treat for them to hear you again this morning. But let's get straight into it. Liam, a big name has put his hand up in a by-election in Papua New Guinea.
That's right. Last week, the chief of the Internal Revenue Commission, Sam Coyne, posted a cryptic message to social media announcing his resignation from the position, but also saying that he wasn't running away from anything. He was running towards something. Now we know what that is. The national newspaper in PNG has reported that he will be contesting the by-election in the Day open seat in the Western Highlands. That's become vacant after the death of the former MP. So Sam Coyne, not only is he the former Internal Revenue Commission commissioner, during that role, he's been credited with modernising tax collection, increasing revenue for the government. It's always been a big problem for PNG, the effectiveness of its tax regime. He's been credited with improving things a lot. And some of our older listeners with longer memories might also remember that he was the chief of Task Force Sweep, which was set up when Peter O'Neill was in government, the Prime Minister. He set up this task force, the first of its kind in PNG, which was this multi-agency anti-corruption group to investigate official corruption, corruption within government and bureaucracies. And there are quite a number of high-profile arrests during Mr. Coyne's time as the chief of the task force sweep. So you'd have to think, and we can't endorse any candidates, of course, on the ABC, but he's a pretty impressive character, and he's one of 35 candidates for this by-election.
And certainly, as you mentioned, there is not a new face when it comes to politics. But let's take a look at Tonga now, where one of the candidates for the prime ministership is backing citizenship by investment scheme.
Yes. According to the Kaniva News website, Lord Fakafanua, who's a noble MP and the Speaker of the Legislative Assembly in the last term of Parliament, is one of the candidates for the prime ministership. They're due to elect a prime minister in parliament, or sorry, the Legislative Assembly, next week following the recent elections. And according to Kaniva, Lord Fakafanua has also been spruiking this citizenship by investment plan that was drawn up by, according to Kaniva, Henley and Partners. They're a prominent citizenship by investment firm. The aim of this is to raise $400 million US. Kaniva quotes Lord Fakafanua saying that it's an important thing. They need to diversify their economy. They need other sources of revenue. And according to a document seen by the website, single applicants would pay $190,000 US for a passport. Families would pay $220,000. So potentially lucrative. And if it came to pass, and that's a big if, Tonga would become the latest country to offer a citizenship by investment scheme, We know Vanuatu's had some major problems with theirs. Some less than savoury characters have obtained Vanuatu passports in the last few years, and there have been a number of reviews into Vanuatu. Nauru just launched their own one in the last year as well. We've spoken to the head of their investment scheme a couple of times, both ahead of the launch and following the first time they awarded a passport to someone there. And Solomon Islands has also been talking about it as well as a form of raising revenue. So it's a popular idea at the moment. All depends, I guess, if Lord Whakawhenua does become Prime Minister next week. And as Kaniva notes, it will be unusual because for some time now, the nobles have kept out of the race for the Prime Ministership and left it for those the people's representatives.
Interesting times indeed there in Tonga with that as well. And yes, across the Pacific, as you mentioned, in Solomon Islands as well, there have been a lot of discussions, and it has been quite a controversial issue when it comes to citizenship by investment scheme. Let's take a look at the Samoan government. What's happening there, where the press secretariat has apologized after an embarrassing blunder over the announcement of the new chief of the health ministry?
Yes, a major oopsie from the government's press secretariat for a number of reasons, both for the details that I'm about to share with you, but also coming after this, you know, the government banned the Samoa Observer from covering government press conferences. We also heard this week about this new draft media protocol where media organisations would have to provide questions to the Prime Minister's weekly press conference at least 24 hours before, and that journalists could potentially undergo background checks, including an examination of their political alignment. So on the tail of all that, according to the Samoa Observer, yesterday an announcement went up on the on social media announcing Dr. Viali Lameko as the new Ministry of Health Chief Executive Officer. That was taken down only minutes later, and another announcement made that, oh no, actually June Scanlon-Lui is the CEO of the Ministry of Health. The government press secretariat then told the Samoa Observer when they inquired as to what the hell was going on. They said, we apologise for this. It was a grave error. We humbly apologise to June Scanlon-Lui, the successful applicant appointed by Cabinet last week. The error is ours, and we humbly seek your understanding. And they also apologised to Dr. Viali Lameko as well. So, not a great look.
Doesn't look like a great look indeed. But look, thanks so much for taking us through what's making news across the headlines, Liam, and hope you have a restful and happy holidays with your family, and see you again next year.
Thank you, Chrissy. Same to you too, and to all our listeners.
Thank you so much. That was Liam Fox, our producer, bringing you all the latest on our news wrap this morning.
Kick off your Sunday with Kuntamari Crofts on Pacific Sundays, right here on ABC Radio Australia. Pacific Sundays is a laid-back weekly wrap of all things Pacific, from news, sport and entertainment to the best island music vibes. So whether you're chilling out, heading off to church or catching up with family, be entertained as you do it with Pacific Sundays. Every Sunday at 6 a.m. PNG time on ABC Radio Australia.
Talofan, welcome back to Pacific Beat. Time for sport now, where for the three leading Pacific nations, Fiji, Samoa and Tonga, rugby sevens is part of their sporting DNA. However, right now, it looks rather like the Fijians are not getting value for money, while the Samoans and the Tongans are still outside the World Series elite group, and with barely a dollar between them. But as Richard Ewart reports, under the new system, parachuted in by World Rugby, winning a tournament in the regular World Series has been significantly devalued. And for those like Samoa and Tonga still with ambitions to be part of it anyway, it's a hard road to the top.
Right now, Fiji share the lead after two rounds of the new World Rugby Sevens series on 32 points, along with New Zealand and South Africa. But at the end of all six rounds, even if they're on top outright, there is no championship to be won. As World Rugby pointed out with great fanfare after restructuring the competition yet again, there will be a season finale featuring three blockbuster events with 12 teams per gender to determine the annual world champions. So, what is the point of the first six rounds, many are asking. The chair of Fiji Rugby, John Sande, says he's not pleased with the new model, but as the saying goes, he's just happy to be there.
You know, it's against the backdrop of the global game and the costs of running it. We're a responsible member of the World Rugby family, and we want to promote and encourage the growth of that, but at the same time, we're cognizant that it must pay its way through it all. For us, it's a very important part of pathway. So a lot of our players go through the sevens that then eventually, you know, move into the 15s, into our flying Fijians. Of course, we'd love it to be a bit different, but it's driven and dictated by the economic factors. We just want to make sure that it survives, then we just want to be part of that entertainment arena.
At round two in Cape Town, there was a noticeable lack of spectators, which may reflect the almost anti-competitive nature of what World Rugby have created. John Sande agrees that it's a peculiar setup and confusing for fans who, based on social media comments, had enough trouble working out who had won what last season.
It is confusing and something that we just have to live with. We're always happy to showcase our product to the world and keep everyone excited, and also our young players coming through to give them something to aspire to.
Bizarrely, what the new format does is open the way for fallen giants Samoa to claw their way back to the top and potentially even be crowned world champions at the end of it all. The Manu will start in the new Division 3 in January and will need to finish top 2 to progress. Then a top 4 Division 2 finish after 3 further rounds will be required to propel them back into the elite group and into the 3-event Grand Final series. Lakabee Samoa's chief executive Douglas Nau Chun is not looking too far ahead after seeing the Manu plummet 2 years ago.
It is a tough pathway, but it's manageable from our end. And it's an exciting challenge for our sevens program. We had a plan last year after we got knocked out of being a tier one team, and then we wanted so bad to get back as fast as we can. Unfortunately, World Rugby came up with a revamp sevens competition globally. So we failed last year. So at least we have another chance to have a crack at it this year.
The Tongan men are also in the Division 3 mix with Samoa, but the team is clinging to life because the Tongan Rugby Union has no money to fund them. But CEO Isia Aholale says it would have been heartless to close them down, as seemed likely at one point.
The reason why they're still participating is because the players and the coaches, they want to be part of competition. And I feel for them, you know, we're here to make sure that our players go out there and compete against the best teams. And to say them that you can't go there because we don't have any funding, it's a sad thing to understand. And they will have to foot a lot of the bills to get themselves to where they will need to be in the immediate future, especially the 7th-3. And after that, we'll see whether it's viable to continue, because it's not good for us to tell the team, no, you got to survive yourselves and pay for whatever yourselves. It shouldn't be like that.
Should Tonga find a way out of Division 3 and go on to reach the Grand Final series, it would be a sporting fairy tale on a grand scale. But right now, there is no guarantee the team will actually survive beyond January, win or lose.
We're continually looking at helping them. It's not like we're just abandoning them. We're looking at every option and how to support the team, especially with a sponsorship. Those things that we can try to move on. Funding from the government is limited. Funding for World Rugby is limited as well. But those things we don't have control of. We're continually talking with companies to support the team, but nothing concrete at the moment.
Meanwhile, back in Samoa, and assuming Prime Minister Lauli loosens the government purse strings, the rugby union has ambitions to see both the Manu and Manusina rise up the rankings.
Both our men and women's team will be participating in Dubai come January. And like any other nation, we're not going there just to make up the numbers. We learned our lesson from last year when we first competed in the Challenger Series, now named 7-3. And we'll come up with a solid team in that tournament.
So, curiously, as things stand, Samoa and Tonga have more to play for under the new 7 setup than Fiji. Fiji could win their next 4 tournaments, but that achievement would amount to nothing if they fail in the Grand Final series. Consistency, it seems, is no longer regarded as a key factor by World Rugby, but they say their new model is elevating competitiveness, fan interest and broadcast value. But is it the case that after all these years and regular changes, World Rugby still haven't got it right? John Sande's response to that question is, diplomatic.
Nothing. There's just more options available to fans and spectators to go out and choose what events they want to be involved in. And we need to evolve the game to see how it can continue to be relevant to the market. And that's been the biggest challenge, I think. It's just a shifting global consumer market in this space. So we're trying to keep up with that.
Right now, the World 7 Series is in something of a hiatus, with Division 3 set to kick off in mid-January, while the Elite Group are back in action, this time in Perth, but not until January the 31st.
Richard Ewart reporting on the ever-changing world of rugby sevens and how it affects Fiji, Samoa and Tonga, the three leading unions in the Pacific. Transmutation, Our Origin Stories, is an exhibition of contemporary mixed-media pieces and features an array of Papuan artistic talent. The exhibition explores the ideas of matriarchal lineage and the female body as a vessel, a powerful channel for the transmission of ancestral knowledge, tradition, and often spiritual or magical capabilities. The exhibition is currently showing at the Melbourne Museum and was curated by multidisciplinary artist Weniki Hench. Now, Agitupo sat down with this artist, Weniki Hench, who curated the exhibition at the Melbourne Museum's Forest Gallery.
How are you doing, Weniki?
Yeah, good, thank you.
You good? Yeah. Do you mind me asking about your story? Mm-hmm. How did you even come around to take up art? Was it always something that you wanted to do?
Yeah, it was something that I was always drawn to sketching, and that sort of started off there with charcoals, which was actually one of the things, just at barbecues, funnily enough. And then carving with just different clay and just digging out from earth and things like that. Funnily enough, my first dipping the toes in was surfboard shaping.
Well.
And surfboard designs straight out of high school. So that was somehow I was incensed to do those sort of design works on there. And then that went into screen printing. Mm. And then for this work, I actually thought of using my voice and tapping into the process of birthing, because looking at the body as a vessel. Mm. With these couple of different works that you'll see inside.
Looking into then hearing what you're talking about, you know, the body of work, and even just, I suppose, how you look into the female body. Mm. Why was that important for you to sort of go down that trick?
Yeah, it's been an ongoing narrative with the body as a vessel and looking at the matriarchal lineage. Mm. And the way that I tap into looking for my own parents and my, well, mother specifically, and also mother country, mother tongue. Mm. And having a look at the way that I can actually translate to my works and the narratives, but also now being a mother. Mm. So that's been really special. Yeah. And, the body as a vessel is a way that I also see is a point of giving birth, but also as a point of telling stories. And also within the way of Islanders and First Nations and Global First Nations and all countries is a way of telling stories and actually archiving and remembering.
Shoulder-tapped to join Weniki's exhibition was fellow Papuan artist Leslie Wingimbo. He's well known for his hyper-realistic paintings and large-scale portraits. Exhibiting his work here in Melbourne is an important milestone for Wingimbo, and one he hopes will inspire future artists back in the homeland.
I would say I'm proud about it in a way of representing my society, or my friends back home. Like when they see me, hope they get inspired. Or especially artists who comes out of PNG who have seen that art is not a way forward. I hope that my practice or even my life could inspire some other people from the village or from the community where I'm from. And that's what I want it to be. There's not only one way of looking at life. Like you can do all sorts of field out there that you can actually make it through. So I believe like I want my work and my life to be that for other young people, yeah.
Led by Leslie and Weniki, we stepped back inside the museum and into the Bundjalaka Aboriginal Cultural Centre. Nestled amongst First Nations history stands Transmutation, Our Origin Stories. A long, wide, corridor-like room, aptly described by Weniki as womb-like. Portraits, tapa cloth, and sculptures adorn the walls when Gimbo walks us over to his portraits.
Oh, yeah, so this is my work here.
Wow. What are these two pieces? What are they called?
So this is called Uncle. He's actually one of my uncles.
Wow.
And then I'm Mian. And the thing is that they're completely different people from different, you know, background and stuff, but I put these connections in a way of, like, he is somebody from the village and been living there for all his life. But then to me, and who lives in Melbourne, who grew up in Cairns, but see her parents is from here. So having this diasporic culture in a way of, like, still connected to the to where she's from. The element that is really popped up is the belong, which is, you know, really, I say it's part of, you know, identity is more than PNG.
A video installation plays in the background. Its music floods the room with sound as strong as the red lights that flood the space, touching almost every corner of the room.
Wenneke, I know we're here smack bang in the centre of the exhibition, but what we're hearing and what I love seeing right behind us is the visual part of your exhibition. What are we viewing? What is this all about?
This video work is called We the Butterfly. Mm. It's actually a video work that's based on our animal totem, which is the Queen Alexandra Birdwing Butterfly.
Mm.
And that's actually prominent in, I believe, mainly based in the Otter province of Papua New Guinea.
Wow.
And so the creative direction with this one is actually the life cycle of the butterfly, and also looking at the fact that the ancestors are actually the caterpillars. Wow. So moving through that and actually having my daughter's actually in here, which is a bit of a proud moment.
Again, that's the thing, visually now, because obviously everything is visual here, but having to use this medium here, what is it that you're trying to display to people to understand?
Yeah, it was a way that can actually, again, referring to the body as a vessel, and that way that we can actually move through the space and use it as a point of healing in a different way that's a contemporary evolution as well.
I hear you talk about that word healing. That seems to be, you know, a theme. Is that something that this has given you healing in a sense of, you know, who you are as an artist?
Yeah, absolutely. Like, each body of work is actually tapping into each part of my adoption journey and also my connection to country and language, and something that I can create a hybrid for my daughter as well, which is super important.
Yeah, congratulations. Well done. This is beautiful.
That was Papuan artist Wenneke Hench speaking to Aggie Tupou about the exhibition Transmutation. And that, of course, brings us to the end of Pacific Beat. Time to take a look back at our main stories. A pre-Christmas constitutional showdown is brewing in Vanuatu as the government appeals a court order to recall Parliament to deal with the no-confidence motion. Fiji and Vanuatu are tapping into the niche schoolies tourism market of Australian high school students travelling abroad to celebrate their graduation. And a Solomon Islands NGO fights to protect women after the WHO ranks the country as one of the worst in the world for gender-based violence. You can also hear us again this afternoon at 5 p.m. PNG time with Aggie Tupou. Stay tuned because news is up next, and coming up is Nija Daily. Until next time, I'm Kristen Rita Omanu Leong with our producer Liam Fox here in Brisbane and our tech guru Chrissy in Melbourne. Have a Merry Christmas.